incensed by this, and finally he opened the door, which was a bathroom. I can still see it. It was a long, narrow bathroom. Bath on the left, wash basin, I think, and right in front was the loo. So he said, oh, well, he said, this will have to do. And he closed the door firmly, put the lavatory seat down, and offered me the choice of the lavatory seat or the edge of the bath. Well, I was somewhat taken aback, because as a very sort of primly and properly brought up young lady, I was not really used to being in situations with middle-aged Frenchmen whom I didn't know. And, of course, this was wartime, and I thought, well, can't be helped. So I chose the edge of the bath, because I felt it was more seemly. And anyway, it was nearer the door. But not that I knew what I'd be running away from, but nevertheless, he sat on the seat and started to dictate. Well, of course, I had my notebook. I took down whatever he had to say. It was the usual stuff, which, unfortunately, we were used to, that they always complained. I mean, I'm sure they had reason to complain, but the agents would always complain that they didn't have enough stores sent to them, the drops hadn't come to where they wanted them, the RAF hadn't found the ground, or they had found the wrong one, or, you know, there was always some people who felt that we were never doing enough for them. But, of course, they were risking their lives out there, and you can imagine how important it was. At the end of our conversation and all this, this good gentleman said to me, what are you doing here? To which I was a bit perplexed, and I felt like saying, well, I'm sitting on the edge of the bath, and he said, why aren't you on the other side with us? And I said, well, what would I do? What good am I? And he said, well, we need people who are, if you're not trained, it doesn't matter, we need couriers. Can you ride a bicycle? And I said, yes. He said, well, there you are. You could be a courier. You'd be invaluable. You're just the sort of people we need. He said, if you're not French, you look French, you sound French. That's good enough. So I came away with my head in the air, thinking, oh, this is wonderful. And at the earliest opportunity, I remember asking Major Bourne Patterson, couldn't I go over to France? And he said, no, you can't. You know too much. And to which I said, well, I don't know anything, really. I haven't been here long enough. And he said, you know too much. And I was wondering, actually, he said, I was wondering how long it take you before you start, you ask me that. So that was my answer, and that was the end of that. And but I was full of enthusiasm at that particular time. I might not have been so enthusiastic if I'd known what it entailed. I'm trying to think, what else did we do? We had in the office, I mean, in SOE, we in F section, there was another group of people who are on a far floor below us, who did nothing but forge documents and identity cards and papers for agents going over to France. And I suppose from time to time, so that it shouldn't always be the same kind of handwriting on these things, they would ask me and other people like me, I wasn't the only one, to forge, to help write in a name or a signature on an identity card. That was one thing we used to do. And sometimes I remember there were messages that used to come, and we had to send them to intelligence on the floor above. Now, if it was MI5 or MI6, I don't know. They were known as intelligence, and some things used to go there. All our papers were marked secret or top secret, but some were marked bigger top secret. I never knew what it meant. I don't think anybody did. But they were only for the eyes of certain people, but who the certain people were, I also didn't know. I mean, I realize how little I knew of many of the things. The other thing we had, of course, were we had two cover stories for my sister and I. We were friends of ours, etc. We had to say we were in the Fannies, and the people would say, well, what do you do? And we were not supposed to say that our work was secret, which was far more difficult than had we been allowed to say so. And because there were lots of people worked in all sorts of things in wartime, and if you asked them, they used to say, hush, hush, which meant, I can't talk about it. But we were not supposed to say that we couldn't talk about it. So one of the cover stories was the Fanny Equipment Office, and the other one was the Inter-Services Research Bureau, Well, that was a bit easier. The family equipment office made no sense whatsoever, because why did we work till all hours? I mean, what could we possibly be doing till midnight or on duty at night at the family equipment office? And we got wise to it, and we, in the end, we told most of our friends that it was the Inter-Services Research Bureau. But then they say, well, what do you do? And I said, oh, I don't know, I just type what I'm given. So that was all right. I pretended to be even more stupid than I really was.
Did that work, or were some people a bit more?
No, they didn't probe any further than that. And we had some very close friends, our neighbours actually, or well, the neighbours where we lived, of our family home. In Surrey, but we used to see quite a lot of them, and one of them, he was a superintendent in the police, and he and his wife never found out till the end of the war what we were doing, and they didn't know even though we were doing particularly secret work. And I remember them saying at the end of it, how on earth did you girls who speak so much manage to keep quiet about what you were doing? And I remember my sister saying, that's the point. We talk about so many other things, we didn't have to talk about what we did. That's how it is. So there was a lot of truth in it. But of course, then there was the moon. Now, the moon was something quite special, and a lot depended on the moon, because drops took place. I mean, drops by the RAF, of course, took place during the moon period. So our agents could expect stores then. We were so used to keeping our work secret, I suppose, that if anybody outside SOE said, oh, look, there's a lovely full moon or something, or made some reference to the moon, or especially to the song which was prevalent at the time, which was called Blue Moon, I don't know, something, you thought, what do they know about it? What do they know about the moon? You know, you sort of got all suspicious. And I'm afraid we were young, but nevertheless, the moon and moonlight had no romantic connotations for us at all. All it meant was pilots risking their lives, and agents also, of course, going out to reception committees and being in danger. Another thing the moon meant, of course, was that when there was a moon, it was a bomber's moon, and therefore the Germans used to come and pay us a visit. When there was no moon, I suppose, really, it was even blacker than normal. But I suppose we must have had cat's eyes, because we used to go around in the blackout and manage perfectly well. I couldn't do it now, I know. Referring to the Blitz and flying bombs and all that. I was going back a bit. I remember that in February 1944, we had incendiary raids. And we had this, our flat was the first floor flat, and it was near enough to Paddington for us not to be too comfortable, because Paddington station was a particular target, all the stations were particular targets of the Luftwaffe. So if they missed that, they hit us. But the incendiary bombs were very unpleasant, and I can remember when one landed actually on the doorstep of the house, because it was a house converted into flats, and ours was the first floor one, and the people from the flats would congregate below, just at the foot of the stairs, which was the safest part of the house to be. There was no back exit at all, so the only way out was through the front door. And on one night, something actually hit the front door, and we heard the air raid wardens outside call to us and say, "Don't worry, whoever's in there, you know, it's all right. We're going to put it out." And they put out the thing, but we saw the flames coming under the door, and we knew we couldn't get out other than. We could have gone up to our flat and jumped off the terrace, I suppose, but I wouldn't fancy doing that, because it was quite high up. I remember it very clearly. There weren't that many people occupying the flats then, but there was a Women's Air Force officer on one of the floors above. Her first name was Joan, and she had staying with her some lady who'd lived in the country, some friend, and this good lady was absolutely terrified. And she kept saying to Joan, Joan, I'm going to scream. Joan, I can't stand this. Oh, this is frightful. I'm going to yell. I'm going to scream. And we were all saying, it's quite all right, you know, please don't bother. We weren't feeling any more comfortable than she was. But she kept saying this, and I felt like saying if somebody would slap her face, it would probably be the best thing, but nobody did. And in the end, we managed to calm her down. And the funny thing is that, I don't know who it was, but many years later, well, not many years, but a few years later, someone met my sister casually in a shop or in a restaurant or something and said to her, I remember you. I remember you and your sister. You were those two brave ladies in uniform who were as cool as cucumbers when I was so scared. So she must have seen her or something. I don't know. I mean, I remember my sister saying, you'll never guess what's happened. It must have been this lady who was Joan's friend. But she was in a terrible state, poor woman, and I thought, well, why did she come to London in the middle of the raids? She lived in the country. I don't know what she'd come for, but anyway, she went back, obviously, because after that she wasn't there, because it's bad enough if you feel bad without having somebody hysterical sort of voicing their fears. Well, there were lots of little incidents like that, but mostly, I mean, the incendiaries were nasty. They weren't dangerous, but they were nasty.
What do you remember of the V1 and V2 raids?
Well, those I remember when, because I first heard of them when I was in the when I was in F section, because I don't think I've mentioned it yet, but later on we had an army lieutenant who came to help us. Well, he was no help, poor fellow, it wasn't his fault, but he was there, and he came in very late one morning, because he lived in Kent, and he came in and he was telling us this garbled story about things coming flying through the window, going out of the back door. We thought, well, he's, you know, what on earth is he talking about? We were very busy and we weren't paying much attention, and he was describing these very strange missiles, and we thought he was imagining them. And then within a day or so, this was just after D-Day, I think the V1s must have started about a week after D-Day, I suppose. And then we realized, and it was on the news, of course, that there were these, they called them pilotless aircraft. And then they got known as the V1s, and then they were known as the flying bombs, and then they were known as the doodle bugs, and so forth. And also, they came and went, but we never knew what, you know, you haven't got time to think. And the sirens to sound the alarm would start, and then you'd get the all clear. And it happened so frequently. I mean, the old way of the Blitz and things like that was you had the warning at a certain time, and then hours and hours and hours later, you got the all clear. But this was coming and going all the time, so you never quite knew if the raid was on or off. Sometimes you'd say to somebody, by the way, is there a raid on, or have we had the all clear? And they'd say, well, I can't remember which the last thing was that we heard. You just took it in your stride. You were too busy to worry about things like that. But as I say, I do remember those things. But and that's round about early April 1944, all leave was cancelled. It was all cancelled for military people. Now, the Fannies were in a peculiar position. We weren't quite military and we weren't quite civilian. So if the military leave was cancelled, we were military. If there were some perks of the military, we were civilian, or at least so it seemed. But it didn't really matter very much. But by April 44, the pace was really hotting up, and the work increased enormously. That's when we needed an extra person in our office, as I was doing both officer work and secretary work. And I asked Nancy about it, and she said, well, I'm very sorry, she said, but you will not get made an officer, she said, because you're far too valuable as a secretary. Well, I must say, I thought it was a bit unfair, especially as she had done precisely what, she'd been secretary and become an officer, but she was adamant that it wouldn't happen. And they brought in an army lieutenant who unfortunately, very nice man, this Ken something, very pleasant fellow indeed, but he I don't know what branch of the army he was in, but he was vaguely technical. which was not required in our office at all, and he did not speak a word of French, nor did he understand any French. Now, it wasn't his fault at all, but it turned out that he was completely useless. But he was occupying what they call the establishment. If we agreed to have the establishment for another officer in that section, he was taking up this post. Well, he was the first one to reckon that I was being very shabbily treated, and I think he spoke up to people on my behalf without me even asking him about it. And he really sort of complained and said he couldn't do anything, poor fellow. He didn't even know how to read a map reference. He did his best, and he used to hang. I don't think he liked Nancy, and Nancy didn't like him. And she used to think, what's he doing here? And he tried to shadow me, but he couldn't type. He couldn't speak French. I mean, we could use him a bit as a messenger, but it was ridiculous to have an army lieutenant doing that. He didn't stay very long. He was there a matter of a few weeks, and then he pushed off. But he was the one who told us about the flying bombs. I think he had a wife and a child in Kent, and he was very much on the flight path of these missiles. And then I think that by about the 1st of June, that's when we started a 24-hour attendance program and shifts. I always got the feeling I was on a permanent shift. If you got 3 or 4 hours sleep at night, you were lucky, especially as we were quite frequently on night duty.
And did you sleep?
Well, you slept in some sort of kind of bed roll on something called the camp bed, and you didn't get any sleep very much, and you slept actually downstairs in some other office. In F section, but I wouldn't say it was great comfort. But we were used to not sleeping, because if you were home, you had to keep jumping up because there was a raid, because the flat we had enormous windows. Mind you, there were shutters, and we'd keep those closed. But I remember we had what we called our panic bags already packed. You see, you had a little suitcase, a little attaché case with essentials, so that if we had to be evacuated from the office, I'd never seen the place, but I was told by another colleague or somebody we knew who worked in SOE, who'd been to see these places somewhere deep underground, where people like us were going to be evacuated if it was necessary. And by the time he'd finished telling us about it, we said, for God's sake, don't tell us any more. We'd rather be blown up 50 times than go under these awful tunnels that you keep describing. I feel claustrophobic at the mere thought of it. Luckily, it never happened, but we had I think there was an alert which was like the traffic lights. There was the green, the amber, and the red, and several times we reached the amber alert, which meant bring your panic bag to the office, because you may not be going home, you may be going on to wherever, but we never got to the red, thank heavens, because that would have been leaving London and going to this underground place. I've never known where it was, and I never want to know. I have no wish to see it. It's not my... I'd rather be blown up any time. And then I think around about... by end of July... Yes, it was getting towards the end of July. I was surprisingly... I know Nancy was away for a weekend, and because things were not quite as bad as they had been, one could get a bit of a break. And Major Morel sent for me and said they were splitting France into three regions. And each region had an officer and an assistant officer in charge. And this one of the regions was the one along the Rhone Valley, south of Lyon, and, well, it was north of Lyon as well, I think. It was the east and southeast, but it included all the Rhone Valley and Marseille and so forth. And that was going to be taken over by Harry Ray. Now, Harry Ray had been an agent, and he'd been wounded, and he'd come back, and they hadn't sent him out again because, it was too dangerous. But he... So they employed him in that capacity. But of course, he wasn't used to the work of the SOE headquarters, so they wanted me to be his assistant officer, and I was made an officer. So I became an ensign in the family, so overnight. You just sew the pip on your shoulder, and that was it. He was a very nice person indeed, and we worked together not all that long, really, because by the time he took over, and we all crammed into this one office, and then as I became an officer, they employed a girl as a secretary. She was quite good. She didn't know a lot of French, but I mean, she was a sweet little girl, and she did the typing and things. And then we moved from there to Montague House, which was behind Norgeby. At one stage, they had this girl, Audrey, the secretary, there, and I was here. I couldn't see the point of that, but anyway, things were a bit of a muddle. But then we all moved to Bryanston Square. And by that stage, we'd been told that we no longer came under SOE, we came under the FFI, which was the Force Française de l'Intérieur, and General Koenig was the head of this. We'd never even seen the man. And he, at some later date, he spoke to us and thanked us for all the work we had done. Somewhere I have a letter from him thanking me for all my work, but of course, as I never met him personally, I don't know. It was just one of those things.